Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. I'm sitting here in my home office looking at out the great big window with a little bit of snow on the ground here in Ithaca, New York. Wish you were here, watching the birds flit back and forth in front of this great piece of glass I had put in. And it's a wonderful sight today. Saw a pileated woodpecker today. You know, they're black and white and red all over. I think there was a joke like that at one point. They've got a great big red cockade on top of their heads, a huge bill. They sound when they hammer trees like a person hammering a tree. Visited with us for a while eating suet. Anyhow, I just wanted to tell you a little something about what makes my day when I'm not talking with you. So glad to have you there. And a lot to tell you about, but let me check and see. Kim, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, you sound really, really good. We're going to have a wonderful show today. Someone that you've heard before, Kim Witczak, and she's a great human being, and you're going to love her if you haven't loved her already. She's going to bring us new information about the FDA and new information about drugs. And I'll share with you some of the information I have. She may tell you a bit about her story, the tragedy that got her to become such an advocate. And Kim is just somebody to look up to and say, hey, you went through a tragedy and now you're doing all these good things. It's a good example for all of us, for everybody, I think, listening to the show, because really for all of us. But Kim, let me go on with my introduction to the show today. This is January 16th, 2019, and as always, it's 4 p.m. New York time when you can hear this show on PRN.FM, www.PRN.FM. For those of you listening on various apps, including our app here for the Progressive Radio Network, PRN. Just a lot going on in my life. I hope that all of you by now are getting my free frequent alerts. It might have tuned you into last week's show with Michael Fontaine, which Michael is a classicist who goes back and just talks about the most interesting things related to love and to sex, to homosexuality, to ancient Greek ideas about why human beings have such deep yearnings to connect with each other, and including the latest from ancient times. It's the latest, because Michael's telling us about it. We've never heard about it before, including the latest from ancient times about how psychiatry was ridiculed in the ancient literature. He's got new examples of that. Apparently, from the very beginning, when medical-type people were coming into existence, Hippocrates, from the very beginning, they were making all kinds of claims for being doctors, not of the body, but of the mind and the soul, and they got ridiculed from the beginning. Their PR, if anything, has improved over centuries as they refined their power and their arguments and so on and so forth. Remember, you can call in. This is a call-in talk show. You can call in on 888-874-4888. Let me give you that again, 888-874-4888. And you can go to the archive where you can listen to last week's show. That was So Good with Michael Fontaine. You can go to the archive on Bregan.com. And for this show only, glad to hear about, by the way, the announcement at the start of this show that there is a phone you can call into and leave messages for all of us who have our own shows. So even when we're not on the air, you can make comments that we might pick up on. But you've already had something real close to that here, your own dedicated email where you can send me messages. And I'll respond once in a while, but I'll always read them, always take them in. I've read all the messages that come in. And the email is BreganLive@hotmail.com. And as you know, I love that email address, BreganLive@hotmail.com. So just a lot going on with me. I've been blogging about my new, more expanded ideas about the role of love, not just in healing, but in causing mental disturbance. And you can just find them quickly by going to Bregan.com and just look at the frequent alerts, because they're mentioned in there. It's a real easy access to get to them. And one of my more popular blogs has been where I ask the question, are all emotional disorders essentially disorders of love? And write me at Bregan at BreganLive@hotmail.com. Give me a call, give me an email about it. Give me an email about it. My YouTube channel, which is really burning up the airways, I guess they're not airways, but it's burning up something, is way over 1 million now in terms of people who have watched it. And we've put up now the first of probably 8 in a series of my interview that was done. It's an unedited interview. You don't usually get to see that anywhere. An unedited, long interview about me and how I got started. The first segment that's up now talks about how I became the, quote, the conscience of psychiatry, and gives you really a look into what I think about my work, how I got into it, what I was really going through when I found out about the return of lobotomy and psychosurgery, and how I finally decided to just leave the comfort of the therapist's office and writing novels. I was writing novels, publishing novels at the time. So go take a look at that. I'd actually appreciate your going and looking at the top one on my YouTube channel. And it's the uncut version of my interview for this amazing film, The Minds of Men. I can't talk too much about The Minds of Men. It's a long film. They describe it as featuring me. I'm in the third and fourth segments. And it's about government funding and influencing of behavioral and mind control. And this is not conspiracy stuff. This is amazing footage, amazing facts, a lot of stuff I had not seen that Aaron and Melissa Dykes, the relatively young filmmakers, have put together. This is really a film to sit down and watch. It had its very quiet introduction in the summer, and then I've been pushing it now. But by the time I got to push it, it had almost 1 million downloads already, 1 million viewers. So this is something really, really hot. And also take a look at my much shorter, I think it's about a 10-minute film, part one of the whole interview they did with me for this movie. And go to my website, take a look at where I'm going to be. January 25th, I'm going to be on Melrose, Long Island, at a huge but free conference. I'll be giving a talk on the drugs, and then I'll be doing a panel on them. And check it out. You want to join me on March 9th in Denmark. You'll find that up on the website under where am I going, what am I doing. So there's a lot of interesting things going on in my work, in my life, and I hope in your work, in your lives, too. And I think that's about what I wanted to cover today, a little more than usual. Don't forget, you know, my assistant Ian worked so hard on this, and I participate in Ginger. Don't forget to check out the daily breaking news. I mean, we have daily things happening on this website. It's moving all the time. This is not your grandfather's website. Remember they used to say that about the car that they said that about? Somebody will write in and tell me. Oh, the Buick. This is not your grandfather's Buick or your grandmother's Buick. Well, this isn't your grand... Even though I'm old enough to be your grandfather, probably, this is not your grandfather's website. It's really buzzing. Okay. Wow. Kim Witzak. I'll spell her last name for you. W-I-T-Z. Nope. W-I... I have it big letters. I'm telling you, I got them very big letters. Kim Witzak. W-I-T-C-Z-A-K. Kim earns her living as an advertising and marketing person. She's been doing that for 25 years. And then she had a tragedy in her life with the death of her husband, Woody, in 2003. And she created a co-founder of Woody Matters, which is a nonprofit organization, and it, you know, pushes for drug safety, for improving the drug safety system. She has become really quite an activist. I mean, she's been to D.C., she says, 50 times or more, and I'm sure she has when you hear her speak. And she's done TV and radio, continues to do it, testifies before Congress. She's just someone to admire, someone to be grateful for. And this part I just don't understand unless it's God's hand. You know, Adam Smith said the world doesn't work unless you have more than just people competing. You've got to have good moral presence in the world. And that's Kim. By some hand or another, she became the consumer representative on the FDA's Psychopharmacological Advisory Committee, on the big committee that deals with Zoloft, the drug that destroyed her husband's life. And she's on that FDA committee, the one I testified before. She's on that committee. It's astonishing. She's got lots of new information for us. Hi, Kim. Would you
talk, Peter,
for a few minutes? I'm out of breath.
Well, good afternoon. I'm actually calling from, as I'm listening to you talk about Ithaca, I'm actually sitting in Minneapolis, where we do not, believe it or not, have any snow, which is a little frightening for Minnesota. So anyways, but I'm not complaining. I actually like it.
We got all your snow. Don't be worried. We got all your snow. We've had snow since before Thanksgiving.
You guys
very snowy. Way before Thanksgiving, we had snow flurries and then snowfalls.
Oh, you can keep it. I know it's good for us, but good for our environment. Thanks for having me again. I really enjoy our conversations, and I love sharing information because I think it's the information that is talked about on your show that I wish was talked in more mainstream, conversations. I could talk about this all the time. My friends, you know, we always talk about it. It's not necessarily cocktail hour conversation, but it should be, because at the end of the day, what we talk about and the issues are real that are associated with antidepressants and all of what I'm seeing at the FDA level. That it's just shocking sitting on being in that role that I never in a million years thought I would ever actually have an interest in or choose to be in. I actually like to call it myself the accidental advocate. I never set out to do this work, and I do believe that sometimes life's circumstances deliver us our greatest passions. And unfortunately, my circumstance in what led me to do this work was a tragedy. But And I don't know, I'll just briefly explain, and as some of the people know, but they can also check it out on the website, woodymatters.com. But Woody, my husband, 37 years old, we've been married for 10 years, was given Zoloft from his general practitioners because he was having trouble sleeping. He had just started his dream job with a startup company and was waking up at 3 a.m., which, you know, looking back now, or looking back then and looking at what I know today, you know, you wonder, well, 3 a.m., it's kind of like, it's an entrepreneur's wake up in the middle of the night, you have things on your mind. But anyways, he went to the doctor, and he was a guy that needed sleep. The doctor said, oh, take this. And Woody just trusted his doctor, and he, you know, the doctors have saved his knees, they've, you know, fixed his, when he got stitches. So he, you know, just believed and did what most people do, which is trust that the drug that they're giving you is going to do more, you know, it will have more benefit than harm. And to be honest with you, I don't even know if harms were ever even discussed. But 5 weeks later, Woody went home with a sample pack, 3 week sample pack of Zoloft, where it doubled the dose. And, he was on the drug a total of 5 weeks, and he hung himself from the rafters of our garage. Here was a guy that had no history of depression, no history of mental health, mental illness. And so literally the day that this happened, I, like just intuitively, even though there were no warnings for suicide back in 2003, I knew that it was something to do with the drug, especially when the coroner said it might have had something to do with, they wanted to know what drug he was on, it was the only thing, and that it might have had something to do with his death. So that was clue number one. Clue number two was the front page of our newspaper, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, had an article that said the UK finds link between antidepressants and suicide in teens. So really, from the night that it happened, to it put me on a, it catapulted myself and my brother-in-law, Eric Swan, into starting to do this work and getting out to D.C. and then investigating it, and eventually had a lawsuit against Pfizer. And it was always about getting the information that the drug companies have known. You know, one thing that a lot of people don't realize, and it's shocking to me, the only way a lot of these documents, and I'm going to send you some of them, Peter, that come out from, that show the company's behavior, can only come out through lawsuits. And the FDA has no ability to get the documents. The government doesn't. So unfortunately, there has to be people like Woody, and there are, I mean, so many people that this has happened to. But anyway, so that really, you know, once you start seeing documents and you know that there were no warnings and your husband's dead, you have to, I felt like I had to do something because it was too late for our family. But if just one family learned, and unfortunately, I keep getting to this day, and it's been 15 years, I'm still getting calls and information, because I think people are just don't understand. You know, I keep saying this, antidepressant use is skyrocketing and suicides are skyrocketing. Is somebody not seeing the correlation?
Wow. By the way, folks, the documents that Kim is going to send me, you know, showing the distorted marketing practices and withholding information, they will go up on my free antidepressant resource center. And it's easy to remember. You can go directly to it. If you don't want to go to my website, bregan.com, you can go directly to it at 123antidepressants.com, www.123antidepressants.com. Tell us a little more about those documents, actually, now that I'm emphasizing them.
Sure. Well, one, I mean, there's several, but one of the ones that's one of my favorite is somebody had, it was from the UK, or not the, it was from the Australian government writing into Pfizer, and they talked about patients on 50 milligrams feeling like they stood outside their bodies looking in. And that is identical to what Woody kept saying to me when I found him one day. He came home from the office, and he fell into a fetal position with his hands around his head like a vice. And he's like, Kim, you got to help me. It's like my head's outside my body looking in. I don't know what's happening to me. You got to help me. And he's frantically crying and trying to figure out why he stood outside his body. And here the Pfizer knew about it. And it said, oh, it happens on all SSRIs. We don't know why. So that was one thing that instantly I'm like, okay, drug. Another one was where they talk about the side effect, which is called akathisia, which is that constant movement, head outside the body. And they actually wrote an entire article, Pfizer chief medical officer, talking about this side effect called akathisia. And quote, unquote, if a patient gets it, death can be a welcome result. So that one was, you know, in the public domain. However, the memo that went with it was sent out to the GPs, the general practitioners, which the majority of these drugs are written and handed out by the, you know, our family physicians and our internists. And it said, Pfizer sent it out to their sales staff and said, the attached journal article is not suitable for general practitioners. Only neurologically inclined psychiatrists. So they intentionally kept that side effect akathisia, which is the deadly, you know, where they literally described it, quote unquote, death could be a welcome result. They kept it from the doctors. And then when you have somebody talking about head outside the body looking in, so that's one. Another one is that, you know, most people don't realize that the kind of the grandfather, or I should say the kind of the beginning of all this was Prozac, and it was initially rejected in Germany for two reasons, risk of suicide, lack of efficacy, and that was in 1984. And eventually it did get approved in their country. But these are things that people have no idea. Then they have the marketing plan where it, they basically, the whole idea of ghostwriting, which basically is the company that hired, either they write it, they have a PR firm that writes it, and then they go get it authored by a doctor so it looks like it's legitimately been being written by a doctor. They had a marketing plan where they're talking about the for social anxiety, and it was all of the plans of where it's going to, you know, what journal articles it was going to be written in and when it was coming out, and then it said who the authors are, and there were several of them that said Dr. TBD. So it had already been submitted and going to run in a journal, but they didn't know who was going to be authoring it yet. So they basically wrote it. So that idea of ghostwriting, you know, I wonder how many, you know, I'm assuming that my doctors are reading these articles, but if the doctors don't even know about the concept of ghostwriting, then what they're reading isn't really right in the first place. And then, so then ultimately it keeps trickling down to us patients, the public, who are the real guinea pigs in all of this. And so,
you know, Kim, when I was scientist approved by a federal court for all the Prozac suits, I had the opportunity to be the one, you know, chosen to see all the inside material in the early 1990s that would be used in the lawsuits against Eli Lilly. You mentioned Germany, and one of the things I found were two memos from German members of Eli Lilly company that were sent to all the heads, the top people in the U.S. and in Europe. And there were sort of a plea for mercy. One of them said, you're asking us to take reports of suicide and suicide attempt and to reclassify it as such things as no drug effect or emotional instability, but not to report it as our own investigators did as a drug-induced, Prozac-induced suicide attempt. And he said, how am I going to explain this to the public or to a judge? Or how am I going to explain it to my own family, one of them said. And then he replied, of course, we'll do what is asked of us. And one of these men was named Claude Boucher, and we have never been able to find him. It's quite a world that goes on around the these multi-billion dollar corporations and their drugs.
And if you think about it, I mean, just the one of the other documents, and I know that was Prozac, but in Zoloft, it was in the Irish Medicine Board, right? So they had to present all the clinical trials. And in there, they went through and looked at all the cases of suicidality, suicide completed, as well as ideation. And the highest percent were in 1 to 30 days, 50 milligrams, and 31 to 40 years old. And here, they were saying it never happens in adults. And so clearly, and that was something that the FDA did not have, but that came out of the lawsuit. And so you think, and if you really think about like clinical trials and what they're designed for, it's really meant to get the drug on the market. So if you think that's the intention, you can create clinical trials with that intention to get it approved. And that's the goal.
Oh, that's the whole goal. It's not the goal. Science, it's marketing. The clinical
marketing.
Trials are marketing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really odd, you know, the emphasis on the clinical trials are the gold standard. Well, if they were done by God, maybe, but when mm-hmm. they're done by drug companies with the oversight of the FDA, they're marketing tools. Every step of the way, they keep them short, 4 to 6 weeks, because they know the longer that they run, the more patients will drop out, the more adverse effects there will be, the more obvious that they're doing more harm than good. The FDA keeps them short. I found an amazing memo by Paul Lieber. This is interesting for me, folks. I haven't thought about a lot of this in a while. It's just sort of coming to mind, where he lamented approving Zoloft because at the time it had been turned down by some European corporations, and he said, since when do we approve things that aren't approved in Europe? We were supposed to be the toughest. We're not anymore. And he lamented this, and he said, we have to approve it because it meets the statistical standard, but we don't see it as being effective. This was the, you know, from memory, this is the substance of this. And then Zoloft goes on to be you know, one of the most important of these drugs, one of the most remunerative and regularly used. And you and I were talking about recent realization on my part that Zoloft for depression in children was actually rejected. It's not just that Pfizer didn't apply. They actually applied to get Zoloft approved for children for depression, which is a big market, and it was actually rejected. And then, at the same time it was rejected, there were some major changes in the full prescribing information. And one of them was that it was noted in the full prescribing information starting just about a year ago that it had been rejected as not meeting the standards of safety and effectiveness. And then in two places, one in the full prescribing information and one in the medication guide, it says that the drug was found to cause aggression in children. So that's probably the hookup as to why they rejected it, because they were finding that it caused quite often aggression in children, much more than in placebo. So nobody pays attention to this. Right now, in some of the communities surrounding Ithaca, Zoloft seems to be the drug of choice for children.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's, you know, it's interesting when we were discussing that you didn't know, and you're very involved in this. I've been very involved in this, and all that I didn't understand, you know, or didn't learn about that aggressive behavior. But I'm not surprised, because there is some of... and just in general, there's articles that have talked about, they have a prosecutor manual that Pfizer helped create for Zoloft. So aggression, impulsive behavior has been there. And then knowing, I think a lot of times people, the assumption is that, oh, Zoloft's well-tolerated, it's easy, it's the most mild of them all. But yet, so that we don't ever hear about some of those things that get changed, or, you know, and if our doctors, every now are they reading it? I don't know. I mean, Does the FDA
They don't know. You
it?
And I don't know. And we,
yeah, that's what I
we
mean.
We really
they
devote
don't.
A good portion
we
of
know.
Our lives. We can't keep
right.
up with all this stuff.
Right. And so I think it's interesting because you were just saying something that both I was just recently and I was very happy to see because a lot of times, you know, I've, like I said, or you introduced, I've been in marketing and advertising and PR my entire career. And one of the things we always hear in the media is like once, you know, everybody's always wants the big story, what's going to be, and once somebody has it or it's been done before, they don't really want to talk about it. And we know that in like marketing and advertising communication, you have to at least have an ad or something run multiple times so that the viewer understands what it is you're trying to sell. So when I think about that, one of the things that's always bothered me is that the media is like, oh, well, everybody knows that these antidepressants have suicide warnings and for kids. And I'm like, no, I don't necessarily agree because, you know, like if you, I mean, of course, somebody like myself and you've been involved in it way back in the 90s and whatnot. But, you know, we did a lot of work in 2003, 2004 through the warnings of young adults to 2006. But if you were a young kid or you wasn't part of your life, but now you're a parent and now you go to the doctors and they're like, oh, take Zoloft. You don't even know that these drugs ever had an issue because you weren't part of those, you know, the media, and it wasn't part of your life back in 2004. Just like the people who worked on it in 91 when the FDA had hearings when it was just Prozac and suicide and violence, and they did nothing with it. You know, I didn't know about that when Woody died. So I'm constantly telling the media we have to do stories about this and remind people of the dangers. And I was very happy to see and the ABC out of Washington, D.C. did a big story last week about the Zoloft, because there's a lot of hangings with Zoloft for some reason, too. But Zoloft is still being given to kids for everything. And I think it's that idea that to even go back and revisit to what we're talking about here, that it was never even approved for kids. It was rejected. And so parents don't even know that. They just, again, assume. And so I think it's really important that we never forget about history and to go back and really look at what's happening. Because even when you're talking about clinical trials and, you know, the gold standard and everybody thinks that we have the best in the, you know, in the world and all of that, that's kind of the narrative that's been put out there. But what people don't realize, including our doctors, is how there's all these new fast-tracking and breakthrough therapy designations that some of it has been put in by Congress. So basically, if there's no drug on the market for that disease and they can't use it off-label, meaning it was never approved for that condition, they can now get fast-tracking. So they don't even need to have two clinical trials. They only need to have one. And so these are the kind of drugs that we are approving or actually looking at the psychopharmacologic drugs advisory committees. And the latest ones last go around, and I think it's going to be interesting to kind of watch it going forward, but is this notion of treatment-resistant depression. So, you know, the narrative that the current antidepressants, people have been on them for years and they're still having issues, or the depression still exists, or their, you know, their issues still exist. Well, now they want to come out with new drugs that either, you know, are fast-tracking it or like a postpartum depression drug because there's nothing on the market and it was going to be an infusion. Well, you know, this was the drug that just happened in November, and it got approved by the advisory committee 17-1, and you can imagine I was the one vote no. And it was really hard to hold my ground.
A brief
not being
clapping.
Intimidated.
Go ahead.
Oh, I like it. Well, it's very hard.
A clapping machine is really me. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's very, it's a really hard place to be because I know, I mean, you can see people are suffering. But if you're seeing the games and the marketing and the data isn't there. And then this idea, so the other thing that's happening in a lot of these approvals, and I believe that doctors need to go and understand how the FDA works. Because if you don't know how the FDA works and you don't learn about it in med school and you don't learn about it, you don't have critical thinking skills. So you just assume everything, right? So, and I think it's done by design, but I think everybody should come and watch one of these hearings, and now that with technology they're televised. But like on this one, everybody comes back on this advisory committee, and it's this was a combined advisory between the psychopharmacologic drugs advisory committee as well as the risk management. So, you know, whenever there's risky drugs. And it was a two committee, and it, like I said, it was 17 to 1. But the new way that these drugs are getting approved, everybody goes around and after they vote yes or no, and then they say, well, if we don't have, we got to make sure that we have strong REMS, which is risk mitigation strategies, risk elimination strategies. It's basically something that Congress put back in play as part of the PDUFA, which is the must-pass legislation, which basically the FDA gets funded by the drug companies and device companies. But it's a must-pass legislation that happens every 5 years. But it was something that was put in place. So anyways, the advisory committee is all saying, well, we're going to have to make sure that that these risk, these REMS programs are implemented by the drug companies, which means that the FDA has to, you know, be watching and monitoring it with them. And I remember thinking, I cannot in good conscience assume that the FDA and the drug companies are going to watch once this drug goes on the market. So I can't vote that I'm going to approve it yes now in hopes that you're going to make sure that these strategies like, oh, you can't deliver it here or it must be taken in this kind of environment and all of those things that, yes, in an ideal world may work, may not, I don't know, but I can't in good conscience assume that we are going to use that as our new blanket way drugs are going to get approved, relying on the FDA and the drug companies to do the right thing.
Because you cannot rely on the FDA or the drug companies to do anything but the wrong thing, the way
and so,
our culture and their culture is evolving now. It's quite astonishing. Folks, let me remind you, you're listening to Kim Witczak, W-I-T-C-Z-A-K, and she is on the Psychopharmacologic Advisory Committee of the FDA. I think she got there, well, you know, when I'm through commenting here, I think I'll ask her, how did you really get there, if she knows. Remember, you can call in, you can ask me or Kim anything you like, and call in soon so we can get you on the show before we end. And it's 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. This is a very good opportunity to ask about questions about drugs that many of you have often called in about. You've got two folks here that have, me and Kim, who have each of us a unique awareness of differing and sometimes the same aspects of the problem of psychiatric drugs in America, which is becoming, and the world, which is becoming increasingly a just a dreadful situation. Kim, are you seeing signs, as I am, that the public is becoming more aware while the government is becoming a more locked down to support the drugs in the face of public skepticism?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting when you, I kind of feel like the public is, I mean, I think there's starting to be an awareness. I think there's still pretty strong feelings on both sides of the issue. But I think in terms of the government and the drug companies, I mean, that's their business. They're going to keep coming things out with new products. And then the FDA, that's, you know, they should be watching out for it, and yet things are getting approved faster. But I think it even, I always go, like, let's go upstream, right? You know, I got contacted by somebody who saw this news story that ran last week in D.C., and it was her husband who was given his, he owns his own company, and he has four, he had four, like, he was waiting for these big checks to come in, and he was, like, really anxious about these checks so he could pay his employees and pay his bills. And so he wasn't sleeping, goes, you know, feeling nauseous, goes to his doctor, you know, somebody new because of insurance change, gets put on literally a combination of four different psych drugs. And I think people are so, there are people that are just desperate too, but we have to, like, think, even, does that even make sense? So I really, like, to, if we could start to get people to actually just ask the question, is that, like, you know, I think about the drugs that he was given. He got two different antidepressants, a sleep med and an anxiety med. That doesn't, at the end of the day, bring those, you know, those checks in, right? And so that is the tools. And I think the government and our healthcare system and the FDA, everything, the tools that we're giving people that are the quick tools, and then aided by the drug commercials that are out there, are that it's a quick fix, right? Those are the tools. But at the end of the day, we need to give people bigger tools that are actually going to be life skills, that are going to be ways that we can deal with some of these stresses that are coming in to our lives. But I do think people are starting to become aware, or at least they're questioning if something happens. But I think there's still quite a few people, like this woman I was just mentioning, that never thought about it until it was too late. And I think that's one of our, both of our goals in life, too, is people should never have to learn after the fact something that somebody else knew about.
Yeah.
And it's too late for their family.
Well, it's a, it's just a, it's just a, beyond me that we have so transformed society in response to drug company advertising that literally all these tens and around the world, hundreds of millions of people are taking neurotoxins. And remember that, folks. And you can look up my blog on my website at under the frequent alerts, you'll find it, that, you know, all these psychoactive substances work only by harming the brain. We have nothing that improves the brain. We have nothing that fixes the brain. There are no biochemical imbalances until the first dose of any psychiatric drug, which immediately causes multiple, probably infinite numbers that we can't even begin to imagine of negative effects on the neurotransmitter systems. And the only way we find a drug to begin with, this is so critical, the only way we find a drug is we find a substance that harms the behavior of animals, that makes them hyper, then it's a stimulant, gives them an extra appetite, then it's not a stimulant because they tend not to, makes them sedated, maybe a sleeping pill or an antidepressant, makes them unable to stand upright when you turn them over. That's an antipsychotic drug. Believe me, it's that simple. It's that simple. That first you show something that's disrupting the behavior of the animal. Then if it looks like what you're looking for, which are these very broad classifications, then you do you give it to some animals and you chop up their brains or do whatever else you're going to do to find out what neurotransmitter systems they're impairing, not improving. I mean, think about it. How would you chop up a brain and see if you improved a neurotransmitter system? I mean, if you chopped up the brain and found there was more serotonin in it, by the way, which they said they could do, but they can't. That's not how it is. You can't measure any increase in serotonin from these drugs. But if you could do something like that, that wouldn't show that was an improvement. That would be an abnormality. It would be more than by nature the normal animal was producing. So the only thing we know how to do is very critical to remember, because it's kind of a little hard to believe, and it's a little so simple. It's hard to believe you never thought of it, or that they don't just see what they're doing. We find chemicals which disrupt animal behavior and then locate, because the FDA actually requires it, the neurotransmitter systems that it's causing dysfunctions in. Then we make believe that we're improving the functions in human beings with biochemical imbalances when there's absolutely no truth to it at all. So it's such a just a bizarre and crazy system we are in. I want to ask my audience, my wonderful, wonderful audience out there, write into me at my email site, BreganLive@hotmail.com. Let me know whether you enjoy. There are two kinds of shows I put on. One of these shows is just epitomized here, where you get a ton of otherwise unavailable information on the harm being done by psychiatric drugs or electroshock or lobotomy, if we happen to be talking about those things. And the other kinds of shows we do are about the positive aspects of living life, about love, about having positive attitudes, about overcoming childhood trauma, stuff about therapy and life. And these are two very different kinds of things for many people. Some people are interested in one, some the other. So just a few of you, let me know what's your preference? What do you want to listen to? It's very hard for me to tell by any of the data that I'm able to get. We get about the same numbers of folks looking at both of these issues as best as we can tell. But I suspect that at times a person might tune in for one and wish they had it. So give me some feedback on what your general impression is, what your friends' impressions are. And I want to take one call in a minute, but I want to come back to something that Kim brought up, which I hadn't heard about yet, which is this idea of pushing new drugs as rapidly as possible for treatment-resistant depression. I don't know if Kim keeps it all track of electroshock treatment. I mean, who would want to do that? But Kim, that's exactly what the FDA just approved electroshock treatment for treatment-resistant depression. They broke all the rules. They didn't hold new hearings. They didn't allow input. I mean, it was just by fiat. At the very same time that a lawsuit that I was involved in forced one of the ECT companies, you can find this on the alerts too, forced one of the ECT companies to admit that ECT causes brain damage. Admitted it. First time we ever had an admission like that after a judge reacted to my report and said, you can go ahead and sue this company. Leave it up to a jury. There's enough science here to leave it a jury question about whether this patient got brain damage from ECT. And they settled. And at the same time, they issued this statement, much to our surprise, that they had reported to the FDA that they now believe that their machine should say that ECT can cause brain damage. So the FDA comes in and rescues them within a week or two and says, ECT is now approved by us for treatment-resistant depression. So this is the new big thing. This is the buzzword. This is the marketing tool. This is the shame of the FDA and the federal government, that we're going to be pushing a lot of new treatments because the old ones that we said work so well don't work. In fact, they make people worse. So now what's going to happen is after your drug has made you worse, you're going to get a new, more damaging, that is stronger drug, or you're going to get ECT because the FDA is going to be pushing by approving, as it's now done for ECT, a treatment for treatment-resistant depression, and then they're going to do the same thing with the drugs. And, of course, what is treatment-resistant? The FDA doesn't define it. Could be you went to a therapist who didn't like you or you didn't like them or, he had a bad day or she overwhelmed at home or whatever. And because that therapist didn't help you, you're treatment resistant. because you got a neurotoxin called Prozac or Zoloft that damages the brain. Actually, in the long run, you know, these drugs we now know, they cause shrinkage of the brain, they cause atrophy, we have studies. So that drug didn't help you, no surprise, your treatment resistance, and now you get either ECT or one of these new big-time drugs coming through the pike. Oh, Kim, it's kind of too much to summarize and think about, isn't it? It's really...
It is. I was going to say, I liked what your question that you just asked your listeners, because I think it is a combination of knowing what's happening out there and this treatment resistant, and also when I learned just about the ECT and that approval, which is really part of the device approval at the FDA, I thought drugs were bad enough, but devices are even more of a Wild West. So I'm not surprised that that got approved, because it's just based on a predicate that was based on something already on the market that was based on something on the market. So the FDA came in, and probably at the same time, it was intentional. It was probably right around the same time that that warning came out. So that's interesting. But I think it goes to the other thing of, like, what are different and healthier and life skills that, you know, if we're going to say treatment resistant, that means that you have people that if we're not giving them different ways of thinking, and you're 10 years down the road, or I'm still depressed, I've been on these antidepressants for years and nothing seems to be working. Well, it's such an easy way when you've taught people to believe that it's a chemical imbalance, that so it doesn't mean you, it's something else that's in your body, like you got attacked by a cancer of some sort. You know, that we've kind of created that whole narrative, but yet, so it's an easy place to go in and sell more. But if we really want to do something, that we need to get to the bottom, like, why? Because our bodies were given us to be, have depressed feelings or anxious, because that's usually your body's way of saying something needs to be paid attention to. Or if there's an old story or trauma from your kids, you know, I think about what we've done, and I don't know if I helped start an organization in Minnesota called Free Arts, and it was working with kids abused, neglected, at risk, and a lot of the kids had been removed from the home and living in group homes and part of the Medicaid system. Every one of those kids that had been removed from the home, they're 8 to 12 years old that I was working with, every one picked up a cup of meds, and I'm like, what? You know, like, it's not normal that what they're doing, but they were medicating it for their behaviors. And I think that is what we have done to society, that it's not you. Well, it's not normal that a kid's been removed from the home, right? So we need to start figuring out and help. And so I like your question about should we be given strategies and talking about other things that are ways that we can help people to not have to use, because drugs or things like that, because otherwise we're going to have that whole idea of treatment resistant. People are going to still, by nature, be, depressed. The whole system's built to make us keep, you know, to keep adding more and forever.
Yeah, well, I think as my listeners, I think, know what I think, but of course, some of you are new and don't know and haven't read my books. But, you know, healing is about coming off of damaging treatments first. So you want to get off your shock treatment. Some people are actually on it regularly. Oh, you want to get off your drugs with good supervision. Find somebody who knows something about coming off medication. Build up your social network. And find the safest way. Get my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. It'll tell you how to build a network, how to find people to help you. And remember always that healing emotional suffering is about having better relationships. Sometimes it starts with a counselor or a therapist, sometimes with a minister, sometimes with a coach, sometimes with a wife or husband, sometimes with a friend. But the development of caring and loving relationships is the single most important healing factor in the universe. We have to face it. It's about love and caring, which heals us, rebuilds our confidence. And there are just so many, many ways to go about that. And you want to do it with as clear, as clear a mind as possible. My friend now, Sarah from California, is a perfect person to bring in on this because she's a regular member of our show. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Dr. Bregan. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Sarah.
Meet Kim. Sarah. Hi. Sarah, pitch in on this. First of all, what do you think people are most interested in on the show? Because that's the question. And second, pitch in on what helps. You're so good at talking to the audience about talking to the folks about what helps.
For me, I think it's a we need to have a balance between what's going on and what can help, because we need to make more people aware of what's really going on, and then those people who become aware really need to know what can help. I know for me, one of the very basic things, when I didn't feel I was even worthy of love, I actually had very loving family and very loving relationships, but I couldn't feel them because my brain and body and everything was on fire. I just didn't recognize what was going on. But one of the easiest tools you can teach everyone is just Martin Seligman's What Went Well and Why. And he has people identify three things that go well in their life, and they have to write out an explanation as to why they went well. And in doing that, gradually people begin to recognize that they are an agent of change, that people around them aren't out to get them, and that the universe isn't plotting their demise. And then they can begin to wrap their brains around, maybe I can be the person that takes my own health by the hand, you know, and gets myself back on track.
I like that. I like that a lot. And folks, you know, I've written a book called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. And the first third of the book tells you about why we have guilt, shame, and anxiety, why we have overwhelming anger and numbing feelings as well. It shows evolutionary-wise and society-wise why we have these. Then teaches you how to identify those things. Are you a person who goes in one direction, guilt, or another direction, shame, or a mixture? How do you know when you're having one? And then learning not to respond. Once you've got it identified, you just say, no, no, I don't go there. And then learning what you replace it with, which is what Sarah is talking about. Learning to replace it with what I would summarize as ethics, reason, and love. I do believe that the way we care for each other and enjoy each other and take happiness from each other and comfort from each other is the most important thing in the quality of our lives. So, hey, thank you, Kim Witczek. Let me tell you again, it's WITCZAK. Kim, you're a marvel. Sarah, you're a marvel too. But Kim, thank you so much for being on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. And let's stay in touch more than
Absolutely.
We do, much more.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And it's just wonderful to talk with you. You're a miracle worker. Just being there. Just being there to let them know on that committee at the FDA is amazing. Thank you. Bye-bye, folks. Bye-bye now.